To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening and welcome to tonight's two-hour live show of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz show. And I'm looking forward to this. We're going to go from the rural areas to the urban areas and talk about the same issue, Roy.
888-245-4237. Call and participate.
Well,
or don't complain. That's how we work here.
Well, we're going to have two fascinating subjects tonight. First hour, the title of the show is Repeal the Endangered Species Act.
Say that again.
Repeal the Endangered Species Act.
And you're not playing when you say that.
The future of the Republic and the destiny of humankind depends in some small part upon the repealing of the Endangered Species Act.
Because it must be serious, because I know in our area we're starting to hear and see paid commercials from people who want the Endangered Species Act to continue.
Well, that's for certain, because the movement is now beginning to repeal it, so they've got to cover up with Band-Aids the terrible mess the endangered species is. Tonight our guests are going to be Dan and Margaret Byfield, who will discuss the ostensible purpose and the nature of the real purpose.
And if you're out there, I want to hear from people at 888-245-4237 if they're seeing and hearing those things in their area as well.
Okay, and our second hour will be a discussion of how Californians, if you can imagine, are rallying against eminent domain abuse. The coordinating chair of LimitEminentDomain.org will talk about the petition drive here in the state of California to constitutionally limit the kind of abuse we saw in the Kelo case. So that, too, will be interesting. Of course, both these shows tie right to the dynamic of sustainable development. And here come the good guys coming up on the outside with the notion of repealing the Endangered Species Act and limiting eminent domain abuse. So, it's turning into a ball game, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be right on with our special guests, Dan and Margaret Byfield. Good evening, Dan and Margaret.
How are you
this evening?
We're just fine, thank you.
Well, good. Margaret, are you with us?
Good to be here.
Okay. Well, let's see where we start. The show is about repealing the Endangered Species Act, and your organizations have taken a start at that. For our listening audience, Dan Byfield is the head of the American Land Foundation and editor at Liberty Matters. If you're not receiving Liberty Matters, go into the internet and sign up to receive that news service. And Margaret is executive officer with Stewards of the Range. Is that right?
Executive director, Stewards of the Range.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for being here, and we're looking forward to spreading information about how it is the Endangered Species Act and why it is that it ought to be repealed. We're going to break away for some commercial breaks here in about 30 seconds. So before we do, Roy, let's remind our listeners to get their copy of the Guide to Understanding Sustainable Development. And you can order those in bulk from us. Distribute it to your elected officials and to your neighbors and friends.
www.f21sc.net is the place to go.
Yeah, those are spreading fast, and that's a good thing. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. We're back here at the Freedom 21 radio show with our guests, Dan and Margaret Byfield. And, Dan, tell us what is beginning with respect to the response to this act that's been around for 30 years and has destroyed so many people's lives and caused so much havoc with our rural lands and natural resources. Where do you begin in discussing this huge subject?
Good question. Well, what we have decided that both Margaret and I our organizations have been in this business for nearly 20 years and trying to protect private property, and probably one of the worst federal laws, not probably, the worst federal law in the country for violating private property rights is the Endangered Species Act. And for nearly 12 years, it's been up for reauthorization, and nobody in Congress has had the fortitude to do anything to correct it. But this last session, it seems, there's been an awful lot of activity, and Mr. Pombo had a bill that he passed in the House, and now it's in the Senate, and everything that we were being told from the property rights movement to be quiet and shut up and sit down to, you know, various things that were going to happen to us, we just decided we were going to take the whole matter in our hands and try to create a campaign to repeal the act. It's just something that everybody's talked about, nobody's ever done anything about, so we were going to attempt to do it.
Well, congratulations to you. My understanding is that the bill that passed the House is bad enough, and some of the provisions in there I'm familiar with, the new provisions for best management practices and adaptive management will give powers to the bureaucrats that will be simple compared to the rules today, because they'll be total. You know, when the bureaucrats can impose best management practices on a farmer or a rancher or any resource owner, well, that resource owner no longer has any of the real meaning of private ownership or private enterprise or private property. Because if you can't decide what to do with that is yours, then what is yours doesn't really matter, because it isn't really yours.
Right. You've lost all control. Somebody else is controlling it. But if you think that the House version is bad, wait till you see the Senate version. You know, we don't even hold out hope that there's going to be anything near what the House passed in the Senate version. So that's one reason why we have geared this campaign to direct it towards the Senate.
Hold that thought for a second, Dan. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guests Dan Byfield and Margaret Byfield. And Dan, as we go forward, if you get a little closer to your phone, we're having some difficulties hearing you.
Yeah, there's a rip buzz on our end too. I'm wondering if maybe we try a different number.
Well, when we take our next break, we'll arrange that. If you keep close to the phone on this end, it's not too bad. During that break, Dan was describing how the Endangered Species Act has lied still for 12 years without reauthorization, a 32-year-old bill that was to be authorized 12 years ago. This year, there was some reauthorization legislation out of the House. It passed the House. It's a bad bill. But Dan is explaining how the bill in the Senate is even looking worse and uglier, and that's what gave them the impetus to do what needed to be done for a long time, and that is to start the fans burning on the idea of just repealing this law that has stolen so many properties and so many life's work and life's dreams from the people, and as it really begins to deny all the citizens of America the opportunity to engage in and work upon the landscape of this continent. The Endangered Species Act is just driving people off their lands these days, and that's hardly an understatement, is it, Dan?
It's not an understatement at all. In fact, there are whole communities that have been wiped off the face of this nation, from timber country, timber areas to oil and gas producers. You know, whole cities have been destroyed because the spotted owl or the salmon. So there's all communities and individuals that have been affected by this law.
And when we get to the essence of the law, the science of the law, what is it the Endangered Species Act was intended to do?
Well, their interpretation and ours is different, but obviously it was set up to preserve and protect and prevent species from going extinct, and the abysmal reality of the law is that of the 1,300 species that are listed, 40 have been delisted, 9 due to extinction, and 16 due to what they call data error. And they can only claim 10 out of the 1,300 species as being saved, so that's a 1% or less than 1% success rate.
What kind of species does that list of 10 include?
Oh, anything from a weed to a mussel to, a bear. But anything that anybody wants to have listed, all they do is petition U.S. Fish and Wildlife. It gets listed, and regardless of whether there is adequate science or not, we then have to deal with it. And they have to declare critical habitat. That brings in the millions of acres of land that then they claim needs to be preserved for whatever species it is. And we did a map not too long ago where we just showed 60 or 65 species of the 1,300. When you designate the critical habitat for those 60 species, nearly every single county in the United States was covered by the Endangered Species Act.
Wow. Well, certainly here in California, the red-legged frogs, habitat set asides, are all over the state, hundreds of thousands of acres, and just is going to bring havoc to each of the counties that this is happening to. And of course, there are so many species seemingly insignificant to the ordinary human being that are the cause for how it is that they're able to grab all this property in order to make their wildland dreams come true. Is there much question in your mind that the Endangered Species Act today, at least, if it didn't 30 years ago, has its real purpose, the creation of the Wildlands Project, along with its elimination of all private interests in property?
There's no doubt in my mind at all. I don't think the Endangered Species Act was ever intended to protect and prevent species from going extinct. I think it was specifically laid out to create a land use plan for the United States to control natural resources and people. Because when you think about what the Endangered Species Act does, that's what it does, is it controls land use and people. And has an abysmal success rate at saving species. So I cannot understand how anybody can defend a law that's that bad and that detrimental to its citizens.
Well, why specifically should people in urban areas care or become involved in the in this matter?
Well, it affects everybody. We can't afford to lose our farmers and our ranchers and that whole industry that is a huge aspect of this nation. But private property rights are just the bedrock and the foundation of what makes this nation great. If we lose the ability to own private property, which is what the Endangered Species Act is doing, and take that away from the millions of people that own land and redistribute it to the elites in this country, then we've lost a great part of our nation. And our ability to create wealth and have security amongst the huge base of our civilization in this country.
Well, it strikes me that when the natural resources in the rural lands of America are controlled by, you called it an elite, I'll call it the public-private corporate socialist dynamic, whether it's the Nature Conservancy or the federal government itself, consolidation of all these resources into the oligopic hands means that people living in the city are going to be at the whim of what that political globalist movement has in store for them. I mean, when citizens own the natural resources of America, free enterprise meets the needs of those people living in the cities. But once it all becomes state controlled, well, we can't rely upon each other to do that. We then are going to have to rely on the federal government or its global governance partners to provide all things for us. And that doesn't make me comfortable.
No, it doesn't make me either. And the Endangered Species Act is actually a great tool to that end.
Are you seeing also that as people are being forced or limited in their management capacities for their rural lands or losing it altogether, that's forcing a further concentration of population into the cities?
I don't know that you see that quite yet, although what you're seeing is a loss of population in the rural areas. Whether or not that means that they're being channeled into the cities like the Wildlands Project is all about, but what they are doing is eliminating the landowners in rural America and turning it over into the wildlands and wilderness areas on a scale that I don't think anybody can even comprehend at this point.
Well, where does all the funding come for all the things that are going on?
Well, a lot of it is private funds from Pew Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, all of the old money that has been funneled into huge foundations, but it's also our tax dollars. A lot of it is federal tax dollars from Department of Interior, USDA, Department of Agriculture, and a lot of these federal programs that are funneling money into conservation programs, into things like conservation easements and habitat plans, and funneling the money to the urban areas to create all kind of urban sprawl and farmland protection plans and everything else. So there's an awful lot of concentrated effort and concentrated money going towards conservation.
Well, yeah, I think I take from what you say that there's a lot of federal dollars reshaping our urban and rural communities to the ends of the Wildlands Project with its smart growth component. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, and a program we put together about a year ago through Dr. Michael Kaufman is called Taking Liberty. And one of the programs that we explain in that program is called the Gap Analysis. And it's a federal program enacted under the Clinton-Gore administration that was an executive order that told all the federal agencies that they had to go out and do this survey to find out how much land was under federal control and government control and how much wasn't. And once they came up with their map, do this gap analysis, then they would go out and implement various programs to try to bring as much of that land under federal control as possible. And that's been going on for 10 years now almost, and most people don't even know that. So there is a tremendous effort in this country through federal legislation and federal programs and money just filtering down from our federal government to create as much wilderness and buy as many people out and purchase as much land and put as much land into conservation easements as possible.
Would you say that money is going into the education system to encourage students to be more open to the propaganda of the Endangered Species Act?
I don't know if the money has specifically gone for that purpose, but I'll guarantee you that it is going on. I mean, there is, for lack of a better term, there is the brainwashing going on of our children all around, and education is part of that. It's hard to get away from. Every single day there's somebody making a statement about the environment or protecting the environment.
Oh, and that's so ingrained in the public schools. They have their own mini Earth Days. They're, replanting plants and, quote, native plants. And kids get to get out of school to go do this.
Well, I would recommend to all the listeners, we talk about the Taking Liberty CD-ROM regularly. If you haven't seen it, get it. When we come back, we'll show you how you can get the Taking Liberty DVD that explains this to you. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station, and with respect to the Taking Liberty DVD, this will take the 1994... Global Biodiversity Assessment proposed treaty, which was never ratified by the United States Senate, and demonstrates how the Wildlands Project that was the subject of that treaty proposal has been implemented. And You know, it's not too late to understand this stuff if there's something that's to be done about it. But it's going to get too late, isn't it, Dan? I mean, if Americans don't come to the realization of this land grab that is stealing our future and our freedom.
There has to be a sense of urgency, and I don't see it except last year when the Supreme Court did what they did in Kelo. That seemed to bring property rights back up to the surface, and everybody seems to understand now what property rights are all about. But to translate that over to environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, people, I don't think, still get it. I don't think they understand that government is regulating private property through a federal law like the Endangered Species Act. The only thing, only difference in between that and eminent domain is they're not paying anybody for it.
Right.
They regulate you and they're not paying you for it. And that's what our whole, I guess, message is about, is compensation and regulating landowners to where they're literally regulating them out of business and off their land.
Well, that's true. When I speak on this subject, Dan, I always make the point that the environmental movement itself is nothing more than a cover for transforming or changing the nature of both our systems of economics and justice. You know, people would not accept going from free enterprise to state capitalism or fascism, nor would they go from a system of equal justice to the so-called system of social justice easily. But it's remarkable how the environmental movement has led most people to accept these huge changes in what America will be. And when you boil it down and take a look at it for what it's really doing, one begins to understand very quickly that the environmental movement is a fraud, and that at the corner of that fraud is the Endangered Species Act. And boy, if that realization starts to take cement, that act is going to be gone, and America can make a comeback. And Margaret, you're working on with Stewards of the Range a petition calling for repeal. Is that right?
Yes, we've both Dan and I, and actually with the help of Tom DeWeese with the American Policy Center, have been trying to encourage people to sign a letter that we're planning to send to Senator Inhofe here in a short while, asking him or calling for the repeal of the Endangered Species Act. And it's right now we have over 5,000 signers, which is pretty good. But we really, one of the things that's happening back in Congress is they think they can ignore the landowners, and they think that the human cost that the Endangered Species Act has caused is something that they can ignore. The approach is, well, let's make a few fixes. The environmentalists, of course, are telling them if you're going to fix it, you're going to strengthen it. And if you're going to make any changes, you're going to strengthen it. And that's really the direction that they're headed. And so landowners' concerns just really are being ignored. And they're not taking seriously the human cost. This cost.
Hold that thought. We'll come right back, Margaret. Okay. Thank you. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. For the stations that were away the last few minutes, we've been discussing the essential workings of the Endangered Species Act, what it's really doing, both to landowners and to the country's fabric as a land of the free. And now Margaret Byfield has begun to talk about the frustration that landowners have had and how they're breaking loose with a petition, starting with a petition to the United States Senate requesting the repeal of the Endangered Species Act. So continue with that that story, Margaret, please.
Well, in order to get, you know, from a political perspective, in order to get the Senate's attention, we really need to have a pretty strong showing. We need to show that there's a lot of voters out there that disagree with their approach and that want to see this act gone. And that's the reason for the letter. And that's the reason we're asking people to sign it. You know, there's a lot of different strategies you can pursue, but calling for the repeal is just a very clear message. It's meant to get their attention, and if we prevail, then that's even better.
How can we get our signatures on that letter?
We have, there's a couple places. Dan and I are in the process right now of developing actually the repealefa.us website. And there is some information that's up on that. It's just, it's been up for, well, it's not complete, and it just has a few items up there. The letter is on that site. You can go to www.repealesa.us, and there is a link at the top to sign the letter to repeal. And so you can go in, read the letters that's going to be sent to Congress, and then if you agree, you know, fill in your name, and your name will be added to that list. And we really encourage people to do that. That's very important that we have a strong showing so that we're not ignored. The other thing that is really important in order to get our message out is to show the human cost, show what it has cost American citizens, the personal lives that have been destroyed. And so another part of this campaign is we are asking people that if they've been affected by the EFA to contact us. You can do it simply by signing the repeal letter, because we'll be going back out to that group and asking, you know, the specific question on whether or not they have been personally affected by the EFA. But it's really important because another issue that they try to raise is that they say, well, we've heard about all these people that have been hurt, but, you know, we can't find any of the victims. And that just isn't the case. That isn't true. So that's another part of our campaign, is we want to, you know, help identify the people that have been hurt, help tell their stories if they will let us, and get that in the forefront so that the real cost of this can't be ignored. Now, a lot of people, and this is the bad part about the EFA, or one of the bad parts about the EFA, is there are a lot of people that have been hurt by this that don't want to tell their story because they're afraid of retaliation. And that's a big problem. But it's really important that we get as many stories as we can out, and even if people don't want their story to be publicized, at least give us a call or contact us through the website, and, you know, let us talk to you, and we can at least get your story and protect names and all that. But I that's really important that we need to put the human face on this, because there's been a high price paid by a lot of people.
What do you say when someone says to you, well, we're afraid of retribution?
Well, speaking from a kind of personal experience, you know, I understand that. And everybody just has to look at their personal situation. I mean, there is a case going on right now with a man in Idaho where he ended up shooting a wolf that was about 10 feet away from his wife, prepared to attack her. And he didn't say anything about that for a number of years. And finally, he did say something about it, because the guilt started to get to him. He began, started getting worried about what if, you know, a young kid was in the woods and was attacked, how horrible he'd feel if that had happened. So he did speak out about it. The Fish and Game didn't come after him for that. But what they did, I think maybe about a year or two later, is they filed charges against him for poisoning wolves. And we've looked at the case a little bit and are pretty sure that was a setup. And so, you know, there is a real fear. I mean, there's a reason people don't want to speak out against this. But I think what's really important is that you have to look at your own personal situation and make that decision. And I'm not going to tell anybody what they should or shouldn't do. But you know, at some point, we've all got to stand up for what we believe is right, and do that hopefully sooner rather than later, and try to make a difference in this debate.
And wouldn't you say that even though some have been affected more severely than others, in every way, every American has been affected?
Absolutely. And, you know, the question that, you know, you asked before about who this is affecting, it's really not just affecting the rural landowners. I mean, one of the the oldest stories or one of the first stories that really began to get some attention that, the public started hearing about was the story of Margaret Rector, who had property, you know, just outside of Austin. Austin, Texas, right here where Dan and I live. And, you know, she had a parcel of property that was pretty valuable, and that was her retirement. And she went to retire and was going to sell it, and they listed her species or her property as habitat for, I think, 2 songbirds. And the value of that property plummeted overnight. That was her entire retirement. You know, that was her savings. That's what was going to carry her through her golden years. And it was gone, you know, in a few seconds. And that, you know, the very nice, hardworking, elderly lady. And so, you know, it affects not just rural America, it affects every American. But there's actually, I think, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but there actually is an ESA bill that is filed right now that I think is very good that we ought to try and get behind. It is filed by Kathy McMorris up in Washington, and it's an Accountability Act, where what she wants to do is have, in the Northwest, you know, they have the high cost of the salmon, endangered salmon, that power prices have risen considerably up there because of the dams having to spill over extra water and losing the hydropower and all this. And I think they figure that for each salmon that they wash down the stream with one of these spills, I think the figure is out $7 million per salmon, they figure that they spent. And so her bill is wanting to put on the power bills up there, require that on the power bills there be a cost listed there, what it costs to protect the endangered species, act, the endangered salmon. And, you know, that's probably the first ESA bill that I've seen that I thought, wow, this is one I can really get behind, because, you know, it'll help show the public what the cost really is to this bill.
Well, I know it's said here in California that the plan is on salmon, for salmon protection. The state is committed to spend $5 billion, that's B, $5 billion on the salmon protection. And right now the discussion is that no salmon can be caught essentially off the shores of California. You know, so you see it in the grocery store, too. The price of beef goes up. I don't know where they're burying these CPI numbers, because you sure see our food costs rise, particularly those that come from industries that are under attack from the Wildlands Project. And that certainly would include the fish and meat counters. So we're all paying for it. Of course, the consequences are a lot more severe than a few extra dollars to eat, because it's really undermining the whole spirit and foundation of America, which is the idea that citizens, not a central government, own and control the natural resources. Well, Dan, how do you think the process will evolve with the repeal of the ESA movement?
I think that it's really surprised me, to be honest with you, that we used to have a partner that called it Rolling Thunder. We'd put out an alert in 4 days. We would just see these massive phone calls going into Washington. And it has kind of been that way. We really just started this about a month or two ago, and we now have over 5,000 signatures.
Great.
I think that we've always been told politically this is nothing that can ever occur, nothing can happen like this. Well, you don't know until you ever try, first of all, but what Margaret has always talked about is what we really are wanting to do is move the debate as close to us and as far to the right as we possibly can, and if something like this will do that, then we've accomplished a great deal. But who knows, maybe 5 years from now, there will be such an uprising and more communities will be affected and economies destroyed and industries gone down the tubes, that people will finally wake up and realize that this is such a horrendous law, we just have to get rid of it. It may be too late by then, like you'd said earlier in this conversation, but it's something that we felt like had to be tried, and we don't like to be told we can't do something, and we don't necessarily listen to the inside the beltway politics, or do we kowtow to them or worry about if we hurt anybody's feelings. So we're out there doing it.
Well, I really tip my hat to you and the people at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. I think this is one of the best movements going. There's not many things that we really think are worthy of fighting, because most of the fights that you're drawn into today in the political world are all dead ends. But when you talk about Kelo-style eminent domain, or you talk about wildlands implementation, which starts with the Endangered Species Act, those are fights that not only should be fought, they have to be fought. And as they are fought, we're going to find all kinds of friends and supporters and tentacles, the tentacles of reason that can spread out across the countryside and turn this worm. And your timing couldn't be finer, Mr. Highfield. We're very pleased out here that this effort is being undertaken.
Well, thanks, and we're pleased to have all the help we can get.
Well, we do have a caller, Eric from Arkansas. Eric?
Yes.
Yeah, what question might you have for the Byfields?
Well, I've been listening to you people talk about the Endangered Species Act, and, you know, all of these kinds of laws, similar laws, are totally unconstitutional. There is no authority whatsoever. When you go for a repeal, you dignify the law, a constitutional recognition that the law was a proper law in the first place. By proper, I mean that the government had some authority to make such a law. They have no such authority. Why don't you guys, instead of doing this, why don't you just file a lawsuit to have the such stupid laws declared unconstitutional, thus perhaps setting some kind of a precedent to teach these green tree-huggers a lesson that they don't have any authority to tell you or anybody what to do on their own land. It's none of the government's business whether or not you have any kind of endangered species on their land in the first place. So how do they know that there is an endangered species on their land? They're nothing but a bunch of trespassers, and they need to be told to get out and keep out. An unconstitutional law is unconstitutional from its inception, and, you know, having it revoked dignifies it as though it had some propriety in the first place.
Well, Eric, I think you make a valid point there, but I think the question about why not just sue on constitutional grounds, you've asked the right man, Dan Byfield.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment. In fact, we have actually done that, and we filed a lawsuit 5 years ago challenging the constitutionality of the Endangered Species Act under the guise that the Commerce Clause has been violated, and that a species found on private property that has no commercial value and is not traded in interstate commerce, that the law cannot be established through the Commerce Clause, and so we filed that very lawsuit. And guess what? We went all the way to the Supreme Court, and last year, right around the time they decided Kelo, they denied our case. And we weren't even heard at the Supreme Court. We had six justices at the Fifth Circuit agree with us that the law was unconstitutional. All we needed was two more at the Fifth Circuit, and we would have...
Let me suggest a different way of approaching it.
Sir?
Let me suggest a different way of approaching it. How about if you had some property owners in that area refuse to allow the government to tell them what to do with their land, and then have those property owners prosecuted in a criminal action with a jury trial, and then have a fully informed jury who knows what their duties are refuse to convict? That way you avoid the Supreme Court, because the decision of the jury is final.
Well, yeah, but you're also playing Russian roulette. In Austin, Texas, we couldn't get a jury like that.
Well, you could
on the Colorado down here.
If you take the time to inform the people in your community about what the duties of the jury are, then you could do it. Learn about this here stuff, just like this law that they're passing requiring all the premises licensing and the RFID chip and the chickens and the geese and the guineas as well as the cattle. all of that kind of stuff everybody complains about because it's too oppressive or it costs too much money. Nobody ever, I never hear anybody complaining about these laws as being unconstitutional or to take it to a jury trial where, and they'll educate the jurors as to what their duties are because there's all kinds of good information on the internet and other places about what the duties of the jury are. Have people go down to the courthouse and pass out jury notification pamphlets to all the prospective jurors and have them arrested for jury tampering, and then let's have a jury trial and have all the jurors on the jury trial review the pamphlet they were passing out and see how far they get with that. So there are ways of educating the people in the community as to what their duties are as a jury.
Well, I think, Eric, you make some very good points. There's a lot of options here. There's a lot of different paths the movement can go. And clearly those citizens out there who understand jury nullification and who want to inform their communities about what that is, it's a key and important dynamic. For those fighting the property rights issues, I tell you, you walk into courts and you make these kinds of principled arguments. And since the public doesn't understand these arguments, the courts are able to get away and ignore the argument altogether. And, Dan, what do you think about...
Thanks for your call, Eric.
Yes, thank you very much. What do you think of the caller's observation that the effort to repeal the legislation validates its original application?
You know, I was thinking about that. I guess to a certain degree he's right. However, it is the law, and it is a bad law. And the fact that it has sat there for 12 years and to be reauthorized and never be reauthorized, but money has been appropriated to actually fund this horrible law, you know, it isn't us validating it. Members of Congress have validated it. I mean, they are appropriating money in the billions of dollars to implement the Endangered Species Act. So I think the fact that what we're doing is bringing attention to a horrible law that needs to be taken off the books, and if that's validating it, then so be it.
Well, really, the only branch of government that can invalidated it would be the Supreme Court to rule it unconstitutional. So, you know, that it's not just that, you know, Dan and I could stand up and say that, and that would be so.
Right.
If only we had that kind of power.
Well, or only if we only had that kind of court that was standing by the plain meaning of the Constitution.
Yeah, and you know, we tried that, spent $250,000 in 5 years of our lives trying to do that very thing and had a Supreme Court that wouldn't even hear it.
Well, and for our local listeners here in Santa Cruz, the case that killed the Byfields cave bug case was the Santa Cruz and City of Oakland medical marijuana case that went to the state, the U.S. Supreme Court, and decided that the Commerce Clause meant that Congress could do whatever they wanted, and so when that decision was made, the determination fell out that Congress, through the Endangered Species Act, could do whatever it wanted with respect to cave bugs sitting someplace in the middle of Texas. Is that a fair summary?
You nailed it right on the head.
Well, you know, the notion of jury nullification is another subject that Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is going to cross over because the caller really makes an excellent point that juries have a duty here and that all of these crazy laws roll on forward because the jury isn't able to do what juries are intended to do. The reason prohibition left this country is because juries refused to convict on the prohibition laws. And so the idea that juries begin to look at these endangered species violation cases and say, no way, that's not a criminal act, firstly. And secondly, they begin to realize that application of the Endangered Species Act to private lands is necessarily a taking of the use of that land. And if a landowner can have to take use of his land taken, well, it's not too much longer before you can have your bank account just taken, or you can have your own home reassigned, or you can be reassigned in any which way. Because if a landowner can have the use of the land taken, there really is no limitation on how far government can go to break the back of private property. Well, Margaret, tell us a little more about what people can do to be engaged in this repeal of the Endangered Species Act movement.
Well, I think finding the repeal letter is a really good first step. And
I think we should put a link on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website so people can click to us, click to them, so we can help them.
We've had that, and we'll keep it up front and center.
All right.
And it's going to, you know, watch that over, we're hoping over the next, hopefully by Friday, we're actually going to have video clips up of some of the victims that we already have, that Dan put a tape together a number of years ago that was really, really well done, where he captured some of these stories on video, and we're going to be putting some of those up. And there's also another group called VISA, Victims of the Endangered Species Act, that has been gathering stories on video also, that we're going to have a few of those up there too.
Great. Nina Pellegrini, if you're listening, contact the Byfields or contact me and I'll put you in touch with them.
And so that's, I think that's going to be really important. We're going to try and, you know, put the face of the victims and get their stories out. And so that's a very good step. The other thing, which you mentioned at the top of the hour, was to subscribe to the Liberty Matters News Service, and that's a free newsletter, and you can get it online. It's a weekly publication, but that's a really good piece to stay updated weekly on kind of the key issues going on, not just on ESA, but other issues affecting property rights. That's another way to stay involved. But if you sign the repeal letter, that's probably one of the most important things you can do right now. Because there is a lot of power in numbers, and numbers mean something to Congress. And so that's kind of our first step that we're trying to build at this point on the repeal campaign. And from there, as we develop other things and other things, issues start coming up or things that we can get more involved in, we'll be going back to that list of people and asking for their help or calls or whatever is necessary at the moment.
Well, the sustainable developers have these huge lists of connected organizations and activist people, change agents and whatnot. And they have a tremendous amount of monies, of course, to fund the organization of all that. The Freedom Movement doesn't have the money, but movements like this begin to organize the grassroots in a way where, gee, I can see the day when state capital houses have... repeal the Endangered Species Act rallies comprised of farmers and ranchers and timber owners and city people and recreationists and just general Americans out in front of their state houses, you know, lobbying for the states no longer enforce these federal mandates to control private lands within our jurisdictions. Do you see something like that beginning to grow over some short time?
I really do. Because that's one of the best outlets for people, and one of the best ways to get Congress's attention. And also, I think there's two prongs to this. There's the educating Congress, and not really educating, but letting them know we're not going away.
Well, I think that's the right point, because
yeah.
There's some of us who think that most of the people, in order to be elected to Congress, you have to be hopeless as to these issues, or you wouldn't have your party support.
That's true. And the other part of this is educating the public. And that still is, I think over the last 10 years, we've made a lot of progress on that front. But I still think we have a long ways to go. And so Tom DeWeese has been doing a number of press pieces. We've been doing some press pieces, just trying to get this issue more into the public's mind. And so the other thing with rallies is that's another way to get, some press coverage, to get this, in front of the people at a, on a broader level. So that's, you know, that's another good avenue. But I think that, you know, we're gonna have to do both things. And that's one of the reasons that the victims, if, you know, the more victims we can contact and talk about, the more stories we can get out into the public, the more we can make sure that this issue just does not go away until it's resolved. And so those two things right now are important, I think, to do.
Let me ask this. If one has had problems with the federal government or state government in respect to scenic corridors or habitat set-asides or, you know, dubious land trust acquisition dynamics or conservation easements, should they be contacting you regarding those kinds of rural land use issues, or are you focused on the Endangered Species Act right now?
For this campaign, the Endangered Species Act, but we work on all of those issues. So if they need help, call.
And to be honest with you, most of those issues you just discussed stem from the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, sure. Do you have the background of how the Endangered Species Act became enacted, you know, sort of the globalist connections to the Endangered Species Act?
The treaties, you mean, and the...
Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of that, and I've studied some of it, and there's, if you've got something, please pass it on.
Okay, of course, Michael Kaufman is an expert on that. And,
right,
and that's part of what we're going to be doing on the repeal ESA site over the next couple weeks is linking to a lot of that information, because we're trying to make the site a really good place for people to go to get kind of caught up on the ESA, to hear the arguments on why it should be repealed. And so we will be, if you have information on that.
Well, we do actually. We actually do have it on Taking Liberty. Michael did do a piece on the Endangered Species Act, and in that piece he does give that predicate, he lays the predicate of how the ESA was created and what it's based on, and I forgot about that, but that is there on Taking Liberty.
Okay, and so if someone wants to gain the information and sign the letter and maybe ultimately hook up with other people in their own community who have taken flight of this issue also, how do they begin? It's repealesa.us?
Correct.
And we are creating a database. If somebody wants to find or locate somebody else in their area, pretty quickly we'll probably have a way of getting them in touch with somebody in their community. You know, they might not even know their neighbor down the street is signed up. And what we want to do is break this down by state so that each member of Congress, each member of the Senate, will know that this isn't just 5,000 people in one state or one community. It's all over the United States.
Well, I think most of us, I know I was, become surprised when you begin to find out that there are a lot of people who, well, most people know there's something wrong, but there's a lot of people with some pretty good notions about what is wrong and what ought to be done. And when we get together, the power does begin to grow. And so all listeners ought to be encouraged, if for no other reason, making local connections to engage in this repeal of the ESA signature list.
Well, whatever you can do to help, we appreciate. And we appreciate all you do, by the way.
Well, if anyone has a call for Dan or Margaret Byfield, the number is 888-245-4237. And as we move toward the end of this this hour, Dan and Margaret, what other words would you have for this audience?
Well, I would just encourage you to, you know, sign the letter. If you're a victim, give us a call, and we'd like to hear your story. And the third thing I'd recommend is to sign up for the Liberty Matters News Service. I think one thing that's been really important throughout this debate and all the other property rights debate has been education. And that's really probably Dan's and my largest focus, is in getting as much information out on these issues as we can, so that people stay informed and they stay ahead of the curve. And when we need to respond, you know, we already have an educated audience that can do that. And so those are three things that I would encourage people to do, and just, you know, listen to this program and just keep educated, and it'll help us win the fight.
Well, it will. And once you get going, the good news of this is, I know myself and so many people here in Santa Cruz spent so long studying and researching and examining all of this stuff. And when you get it boiled right down with all of its complications and all of its tentacles, it's really a very simple dynamic. You know, America is being taken apart from within, and the focus of that is the attack on private property. And to do that, they use the environment, and the goal, though, is to change our economics to public-private partnership from free enterprise, and to change our system of justice from equal justice, where we're all equal under the law, to social justice, where we're sort of regimented into the category of one status of human drone or another, and the law deems that it knows how our life individually should be lived. And you know, if you don't want that form of economics and that form of justice, don't fall for this environmental movement trap. And if you've got that figured out, you know, the first step to take is to get rid of the Endangered Species Act. And the more you study it, the clearer that realization, I think, becomes.
Very well stated.
And those who do want to do the study, some great sources are include Stewards of the Range, of course, our website at Freedom21 Santa Cruz, freedom.org with Henry Lamb, Sovereignty International with Michael Kaufman, Ed Watch on the educational issues and sustainable development, American Policy Center, Tom DeWeese. And there are numbers and local ones that are popping up all the time. You know, Roy, we've had communications from Canada, boy, they've got some real action happening up there. I mean, people are taking to the streets in defense of private property in Canada, of all places. I suppose maybe that shouldn't be surprising. They've been so suppressed there for so long. But that's the kind of activity that I think we should expect and help foster here in the United States, where private property becomes a banner cry. If mom and dad lose their home, you know, their children aren't far behind. So
let me make one statement, too, about the Endangered Species Act that everybody needs to remember. And one of the reasons why private property owners are so up in arms is that of the 1,300 species, 90% of all listed species are on private property. 90%. So a lot of the people think that it's just out there saving grizzly bears or wolves or whatever it is. They have to start thinking in terms of it is affecting an individual and an individual's private property rights.
Well, and it's all based on junk science and lies.
Well, and it's not all about bears, you know. Here in Santa Cruz, it's about wallflowers and salamanders. So we've got to decide whether human beings are more important than plants and bugs and animals, or whether, as the sustainable developers would assert, we're all the same.
That's exactly right.
I think the other part of that statistic, what's really interesting about the 90% on the being on private property.
You went to sleep, didn't you?
Is that 45% of the land is owned by the government. So I think it's a pretty good indication that the government's not doing a very good job managing the land, or private property is really the target of the ESA.
Well, Michael's taking a leak right now.
I think we're off.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. We want to apologize to our last guests, Dan and Margaret Byfield. We were so, but you know, one, they're so good and the cause is so great that we went over our time and so the network cut us off. So we apologize to them.
And to our listeners.
And to our listeners.
Well, Roy, this hour is going to continue on the same theme, that is government's theft of private property, this time not by the indirect method of regulating the rural landowner, but through the formation of public-private partnerships that come in and make deals with your city council and take your house so that the partner can build their own business. It's called abusing eminent domain. That'll be an interesting, very interesting topic as we...
But before we move on with that, you know, the last hour was so critical, and we had that caller from Arkansas, and he had a lot to say, which reminded me of many of the times when you talk about community plans, sometimes you just have to say no.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's the principle that is being fought over here. And oftentimes the clever opponent, the anti-private property force, will give you a couple of options, both of which end up with the result they like. So you end up with the proponent, and then you end up with organized opposition. And so often the innocent citizen falls prey to that cute little trap that is continually set by the advocates of sustainable development. And, you know, I think the caller was a little different than that, but he's still approaching the issue of, you know, what's really the essence and what's really key here. And it certainly is the case that the Endangered Species Act, at its root, is simply misplaced. And, you know, it's appropriate for a state gaming commission to say, hey, there's no shooting in this state of the bald owl.
The bald eagle.
You know, there's no shooting of it, and that's clear enough. And if you shoot, you're in trouble. But all of this harming and best management practice, habitat rules that strip private property away from the people is the wrong thing to do. And now the city folks are starting to see the same dynamic coming into their towns as neighbors have their homes put at risk for redevelopment.
Under the guise of strong neighborhoods.
Yes, talking about the city of San Jose. Well,
but before we get to that, you were recently out of town. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I went to Alabama.
Every time you hear these things, it's like going to school for me. You come back and there's always good things to learn.
Well, it was fascinating. I went to the Mises Institute to participate in a panel on sustainable development. Steve Yates, Henry Lamb, and myself presented to this group of laissez-faire economists who center themselves the Austrian School of Thought in Auburn, Alabama. So we made a presentation there to people who generally had no real understanding of sustainable development, and by the time that hour and a half ended, these people got it. These are good writers, and I suspect that, inch by inch, we
continue to spread the information in a way that more and more people begin to focus attention on this grand takedown of the American experience.
Now, are you finding people, when you talk to folks about sustainable development and what's going on with it, are you feeling that people are more open to it, or do they have those crazy looks on their faces like I did the first time you were telling me about it?
Well, I think people are increasingly comfortable with discussing the issue because there aren't too many people who wouldn't conclude something's off. And the beauty about sustainable development is that it is a comprehensive plan for all human action. So you can point to all the little firestorms going on here and around the world, and you can make direct links to sustainable development. But the other thing sustainable development does is once you understand its premise, it's very easy to boil it down and see it in your neighborhood. And it does reconcile the difficulties. I mean, understanding sustainable development helps you reconcile what it is and why it is that the things that are going on are going on. So people are much more receptive, you know, and I think now any group of people, well, in an hour or less, it's easy to demonstrate that there's something very serious afoot.
Well, the more I learn, the more I find it easier to, because everybody, when you just talk to them casually, has a complaint about something that's going on with the government or how they're spending money or, you know, something. And I find it very easy now to say, well, you know what? If you're really interested in really knowing about how things work, you know, take a look at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website. Start there, and at your leisure, you know. What I was like to say, don't believe what I'm telling you. You know, go do research, and then we'll continue to have this discussion. And I don't get that funny look. They look like, you know, we kind of understand that there's some stinky things going on.
Various activity.
And you know, we'll take a look at that.
Well, you know, what my presentation in Auburn focused on was how what's emerging is a sense is the reality of a political globalist agenda that calls for the creation of global state capitalism. Now, what that means is capitalism run by the state, usually in partnership with their buddy businessmen or certain multinational corporations. And this state capitalism is showing itself by way of the assault on America's land and natural resources. That was our last hour, the Wildlands Project. Two is the growth of government-business partnerships and the growing war on free enterprise. Now, that's what Steve Yates talked about, and it was a brilliant talk, which we posted today at the Freedom21SantaCruz .net website. So that's one you're going to want to remember. You see, what's happening in your community, I know that because it's happening in every community, is these new public-private partnerships, which is to take the power of the purse, the business, with the force of the sword, the government, and put them together. Well, that's the definition of tyranny, and that's what sustainable developers espouse all the time. And then, of course, the other Agenda 21 issues that I pointed to was that human health care, as Dr. Madeline Cosman taught us so ably, is about the surrender of individuality to sustainability. And then also what's happening is that we're embedding a system of, quote, comprehensive planning, unquote, which is the reinvention of government. That was Al Gore's program, and it's coming into full fruition everywhere. Agenda 21, the state capitalism that is coming from that, is also redefining Christianity toward a global one-world religion. We've got central control of education in America now under sustainable development policies, where we're building global citizens and human drones. And next week, we're going to have Michael Chapman on the show, and we're going to talk about that. That'll be a good show. And, of course, at the center of the economics is the political globalist trade policy, all these silly trade pacts that we're finding America getting into, which is just eroding our national sovereignty right away. And underlying all of it is the uncertainty with this monetary system that is sort of being run ragged with the expensive appetite of sustainable developers. So there's there's a lot to know, but once you get the big picture, you know, there's even more to see, and the opportunities can become great. So it was a good session, and I'm looking forward to additional friends of this freedom movement.
Well, you mentioned Madeline Cosman, and I was lucky enough to attend the Reno conference and hear her speak there. After that, she was a guest on this. I know she's been a guest on this program
a number of times,
but I was fortunate enough to do an interview with her myself. But there is some sad news regarding her.
Well, as has been reported, Madeline died from a devastating illness, a short-lived illness, just several weeks ago. And the wonderful acknowledgments of Madeline are swirling the internet today, and I intend to contribute to that, because I've rarely met such a dynamic and warm and decent and brilliant and exciting performer in my life.
Classy. I mean, you just can go on and on. She's just marvelous.
Yeah, so that's a huge loss for our family, for those of us at Freedom 21 individually, for the freedom movement, for all the people and organizations that she was coordinating with and working with. Her energies were remarkable in her interviews. If you've not heard them, go to our archives. The one that sticks in my mind is her interview on sustainable medicine, which was going to be her topic at the Mises Institute last week. And we sorely missed that presentation.
And we'll miss her this year at Cincinnati. Talk a bit about what's going to be happening there.
Well, I can talk about what Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is going to be doing in Cincinnati. The Freedom 21 conference organized by Henry Lamb will be in Kentucky, right outside Cincinnati, Ohio. And the theme is how to. So Henry's bringing some people in to discuss how it is, how to bring liberty back to America. And our session will be on the first day, 90 minutes, and tentatively we've scheduled Joanne Nathan and Daniel Beckett to talk on community planning. And of course they've had something of a roadshow here, both locally and other places around the state, on community planning, and boy, those two really understand it and can really demonstrate and show how community planning comes in, what it does, how it operates, and how it is you can stop community planning. And of course, at the core of sustainable development and all this private property grab is community planning. It's the American version of the old Chinese five-year cultural and social plans, only they're much more detailed, much more comprehensive. That's their word, and that's something we need to be aware of. And so we're going to start the conference out on our session by giving people some understanding of how to deal with comprehensive planning. And I just think of all the guests on this radio show who've helped me understand that, from Bev Ekman to Charlotte Iserbeet and so many other people who've had some focus on just that subject. And then you, Roy, you're going to talk about the tools that are available to every community in this country for spreading the word and pushing back on this demonic monster that's infiltrating our communities.
Whether it's the ones we have on our website or our opportunities to bring Freedom 21 Radio to a neighborhood near you.
That's right. And if you're on the internet and you want to bring Freedom 21 Radio to a local air station, give us a call. We can give you the methodology, and if you can find an interested carrier, then it's a simple process. So that'll help you not be in the woods on your own. The word can spread further, and you'll have some friends to associate with and bring improvement to your community. Well, this hour we're going to talk about smart growth and its natural governmental outreach, which they call eminent domain. Yeah, smart growth is implemented today by, in many ways, but the eminent domain is a necessary ingredient for the smart growthers to be able to come in and make their utopian village plan, eco villages, community planning, etc., happen. So tonight our guest is Lorraine Wallace, who's the coordinating chair of LimitEminentDomain.org, and she's going to discuss the California petition drive that will amend the California Constitution to prevent kilo-style property takings. Now, a kilo-style property taking is when the government gets a little business buddy, and they decide to condemn your property so the business buddy can go out and make some profits and pay higher taxes. And Supreme Court said that was okay. So listen in this hour and discover one step that you can take that can result in one giant step toward restoring freedom.
And if you want to participate, 888-245-4237. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you.
You know, my long-winded bumper sticker on this subject would be this, Roy. It would be control eminent domain abuse. Stop smart growth public-private partnerships. Because that's what this eminent domain abuse is all about. It's when Pfizer comes in and combines with the City of London to put a Pfizer plant on your house. And I certainly don't want that to happen to me, but I don't want that to happen to any of my neighbors or countrymen. And so that's why this is an issue that rallies the need for mutual support. Because I'll tell you, if we don't support our neighbors on this one, there'll be no support there for us when they come to take our house or business. So, Lorraine Wallace, good evening.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. You got to me earlier than I thought you would. And my bumper sticker that I would like everyone to have on their car has a yellow background with black, which says, download your petition at www.limiteminentdomain.org. So mine's shorter than yours, but can you get them on every car?
Well, at least the ones who are listening to us.
Great. Thank you so much for letting me participate on this program. We have very, very common issues. I am the chair, as Michael said, of the coordinating committee for a volunteer, totally volunteer, grassroots, nonpartisan committee who has put together an initiative to which we hope to qualify for the California ballot in November, which means we need 800,000 signatures by April 30th of 2006. That's a whole lot of signatures. And this is such an important issue. Yes, it is a real tool for what's called smart growth. And because smart growth can be so implemented by eminent domain and cannot be implemented without eminent domain. And we're not against eminent domain for schools, roads, highways, libraries, public use, which the Constitution provides. But we are so against the taking of private property for private gain, just as the Supreme Court said could be done in Kelo versus New London.
No eminent domain for private gain. That's a catchy slogan.
Well, it's more than a catchy slogan. It's a really important point and issue, because people should be secure in their homes, businesses, and in their churches. that they cannot be taken and given to somebody else that thinks they can provide more economic, quote, economic benefit to the government. And we in California, and not only California, but throughout the United States, but we are particularly concerned with this in California because in the Kelo decision, the majority opinion in the Supreme Court said that, yes, the government can take private property and give it to another private person for economic benefit, but individual states can do something about this if they want to change their law. And this is what we are trying to do with a constitutional amendment in California. But this taking of private property is happening all over us. Right now in California, a group of small businesses on the corner of Hollywood and Vine is being taken by eminent domain. They are going to have a rally on Saturday, March 25th from 1 to 4 p.m. I hope that all of the listeners who are anywhere in the neighborhood will be there to support this group of small businesses who are being taken. Sustainable development is a nice catchy word, but true sustainable development in this country and what it has always been has been where the small business person sets up a business and functions and continues to stay in business, not because the government supports him, but because he provides a service that the people within the neighborhood want and need. And we now have this whole different concept where the government determines what should be in a neighborhood. So some of these people in this corner of Hollywood and Vine have been there for over 30 years, and they are being displaced because the city of Los Angeles has determined that there is a better use for that property. And this is actually what we're talking about with this initiative. There's a church in Long Beach which was taken last week by eminent domain, the Filipino Baptist Church, and it was taken because the city of Long Beach determined that it would be much better to have condominiums in that area. And so the church has been told that it has to leave. This is wrong. And this is what we are fighting.
Wow. That's very nicely expressed. Being at your grassroots, what are your chances for obtaining the signatures that you need? And when you say grassroots, what you mean is you're not funded and you're coming at this with some others as individuals?
Good Americans.
Good Californians.
You've brought something that, you know, that really came to the forefront to me today. We are a voluntary organization. We have no funds. We have no paid signature gatherers. We are doing this entirely by volunteers. We are grassroots. We started out as people who either ourselves or members of our family, or other people that we knew were affected by the threat of eminent domain or the actual eminent domain. And I'll tell you a little bit about San Jose and how I got involved with this. But
right.
We are a group of people who got into this because we got hit over the head. And this was something that we all had said, we would have said, and we continue to say, this can't happen. Get it? Because this is America, and your property cannot be taken and given to someone else. Well, we learned that it could be, and so we relied, after the Kelo decision, the Kelo versus New London last summer, in which the United States Supreme Court said it was all right for the city of New London to take property, and so that it could be used for the benefit of Pfizer, the large drug company, who was their largest taxpayer, who wanted to have a fancy marina and some fancy offices and expensive hotels, and it was perfectly all right to displace people who had lived in this property some of them, one lady who was 84 years old was born in the house that she was living in. Her family had lived there before. None of this was blighted. You know, it's not like it was a slum area that had to be cleared out. It was just because somebody else wanted it. And so when this came up, a lot of people realized that, you know, we weren't just a bunch of crazies who said that something like this could happen, because it just couldn't happen here. They realized, yes, this can happen to you. And so we relied upon our legislators in the hopes that they would get legislation passed here in California, as other people throughout the United States hoped would happen in their states. And we discovered some very interesting things. We had a Senator Tom McClintock, who, you know, deserves so much praise, because the day of the Kelo decision, he came out and said, this is wrong, and I am proposing a constitutional amendment that I'm sending to the legislature in the hopes of putting an initiative on the ballot. And at that time, it actually could have made last November, when California was initiative crazy, on the November ballot. He was not able to get that legislation out of committee because of the very, very strong special interests who made sure that there's no way that this, you know, that this kind of an amendment would pass. So we then hoped for the legislators to do something with respect to an initiative.
Who were those special interests that fought this so effectively?
The special interests here were the California Redevelopment Association, which is the umbrella group for all the redevelopment agencies in the state of California, and the California League of Cities, which united with them, both of which are very tied with developers who rely upon eminent domain in order to actually get, in some circles it's called corporate welfare, or subsidies to take over land.
Now, we just call it state capitalism. You know, when I was in school, they called it fascism, but that's no longer fashionable. So we'll just call it state capitalism.
Yes, private-public partnerships.
Bingo.
Okay. So we waited, and who are we? I was part of what, first of all, was the 40 sites in San Jose. And we were a group of people who, in 2001, received letters, certified letters, from the Redevelopment Agency of the City of San Jose, who, by the way, is the mother of all redevelopment agencies and has the largest redevelopment debt of any redevelopment agency in the state of California. And they said that, we have determined that your properties are ideal for development, and we are going to ask the City Council, City as a redevelopment board, to issue a request for qualification, and we will then select a developer for your property. If you can work with the developer, that would be very nice. If not, we will take your property by eminent domain and transfer title. Well, you know, that's a real wake-up call. And, like, the property that, they called it 40 sites, but there were actually approximately 150 properties in San Jose involved in this. And the site in which my properties were located contained 11 properties. None of these properties were blighted. Nobody claimed they were blighted. But they were going to be...
So you had buildings on these?
It was an interesting cross-section. I had a Victorian and a triplex. There were a couple of restaurants. There was an apartment complex. There was one restaurant that had just been renovated for $1 million. Beautiful restaurant. It was a Hispanic restaurant, Tico Tacos, and but they determined that that nice block would be ideal for high rise, high cost, high density housing to provide a critical mass of shoppers for a shopping center which was to be built nearby, also being taken by eminent domain. Well, and part of the thing, I think we were very fortunate because they hit so many of us. And so we were able to get some public support, which we wouldn't have otherwise. But it was very interesting in dealing with the local newspaper. We met with the editorial board. They told us that they totally admired what we were trying to do, but their advice to us was to get the attorney who could get us the highest price when our property was taken, because there was no way to fight the city on this. You know, those were fighting words also, and we fought, and we actually won. You know, we did the whole bit. We had not for sale by owner signs on our houses, and on our properties, which also said, which gave the, it said, not for sale by owner, call SJRDA to see if you qualify to take. And we put the redevelopment agency's phone number. And, of course, their lines went off the wall because these properties were, you know, were beautiful properties. And everybody saw the signs that looked just like real estate signs, and they all called up to find out how they could buy the properties. And so the redevelopment agency was very upset about this. And
you weren't acting like a compliant good citizen.
Excuse me?
You weren't acting like a compliant good citizen.
Well, that's,
you know, the common good for the most in your mind. I mean, you could have given those properties to the redevelopment agency of San Jose, which has destroyed so many people's lives.
Well, but what happens is that the redevelopment agency asked the police department to come and take the signs down. And the police department said, you got to be kidding. On private property? No way. So the redevelopment agency got three city employees with a truck who went out and took down all the signs. Well, actually, that was very good for us because we got national publicity on it, and our not-for-sale-by-owner signs are now being used throughout the United States. But we did win. We got an ordinance that said our properties, these particular properties, the 150 properties involved, could not be taken by eminent domain without the written consent of the owners of the property. So then, you know, that was good. All our properties were saved. But lo and behold, about a year or so later, out came this wonderful Motherhood and Apple Pie Strong Neighborhoods Initiative.
They never quit, do they?
No, but they get more clever. You know, they have this wonderful PR to work this out. Well, you know, this is a wonderful thing. You were going to have your potholes fixed. There were going to be trees. Everybody was going to get parks and all this thing. And then they appointed, they had to elect PAC committees, project action committees, or project
action,
area, project area,
co-
project area committees. And they had NACs, which were neighborhood action committees. But they didn't tell anybody that the reason they had to have a PAC committee was that they were extending the redevelopment area so that it would then cover one-third of the city of San Jose. And
that's hundreds of thousands of people are now with a blight designation in the city of San Jose, so that the redevelopment agency can come in with their favorite developer partner, the insider, and take those homes and businesses. One-third of the 15th largest city in the United States.
That's right. But it goes back to something that you said earlier on about, planning and comprehensive plans and such. These were supposedly grassroots groups.
But
nobody told them that the reason that they had to have a PAC was that by law, if a redevelopment area is going to include the power of eminent domain to take residences, they must have a project action committee. So 2 years later, after working their little heads off, and they really did, you know, these people were wonderful. They put in so much time for this, and they didn't realize that they were what actually was called a guided grassroots group, and they were very well guided.
And then they had a facilitator.
They had several facilitators.
They were paid by whom?
By the redevelopment agency.
I just want to stop for a second here and ask the listener if they know this is going on in their community. Because I'll tell you, it is going on in the listener's community just
wherever you are.
Just as it's going on in Santa Cruz and as Lorraine is describing it in the city of San Jose, it is happening in every county in the country. And if you're not aware of the comprehensive plan for your community, then you got some discovery work to do.
And listen to the words that she's using. Listen to the different words, because they might be a little bit different in your community, but it's still the same thing.
Go ahead, Lorraine. I'm sorry.
Well, it's guided grassroots. That was kind of a Freudian slip that somebody from the redevelopment agency gave in a newspaper article, and you know, it has always stuck in my mind because of that. But there are a lot of buzzwords where people are made to feel that they are, quote, empowered.
Stakeholders?
Yeah, stakeholders. That's a really good word. And they use a lot of that. But when the bottom line comes down, it's the plan is already in place.
Predetermined outcome?
Well, how cynical of you. But
you've had these shows before, Lorraine.
Okay. But
the same story comes from everywhere, and we make light of it only because it's so ludicrous that you have to find some humor in it.
Well, it's laugh or cry, you know.
Well, exactly. And it was like with this Strong Neighborhood Initiative, and these people worked so hard for 2 years to develop the plan. Now, by law in California, you are not required to have an eminent domain provision in a redevelopment plan. You can have a redevelopment plan without that. When the plan was 2 weeks before the plan was written, you know, it was worked and it was always in little pieces, the PAC was told that the eminent domain provision had to be in the plan. And they were told that if they did not pass it with the eminent domain provision, the whole thing was knocked out and they would have to start all over again. Well, you know, I mean, where do you go from there? And it was always, eminent domain is a last resort. We rarely use it. When it was brought up after the Kelo decision that, you know, that in California we were going to do something to end eminent domain, one of the counsel for the Office of Redevelopment in San Jose said, we have to have eminent domain in the provision. We don't use it, but it gets people's attention, and we have to have it for negotiation. And it's just like the robber uses the gun as a last resort. He tells you, I won't shoot you if you give me the money. But if you don't give me the money, that will be my last resort, and I'll shoot you. And this is what we've seen so often in the redevelopment agencies and other agencies. It has spread way beyond redevelopment.
Absolutely.
When you talk about smart growth, we're talking about the transit villages, all of these other agencies, they have seen this marvelous power. And when you tell people that you either sell at what we're willing to pay or we will take your property by eminent domain, people can't afford to fight it. In San Jose, we had the Tropicana Shopping Center, which was being taken from the owners who had just built new pad buildings, beautiful buildings. And the center was to be taken in toto and transferred to another developer from out of town who was in favor of, he was one of the redevelopment agency's favored developers. And it was going to be taken, and in this case, the shopping center owner fought it in court. And it was a long, hard battle, and it cost over $1 million in legal fees. He won. But how many of us have $1 million in our back pocket to fight this?
Well, that's exactly the point, and that's why we all got to stand up, like we spoke in the last hour. It's why we have to come to the defense of our neighbor's private property, because if we don't, it's going to be ours in the end that gets lost over to this new system.
Excuse me.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Did you attend these, quote, planning meetings?
I did on occasion. I did not sign up to be part of the pack.
I'm not sure they didn't want you to be there.
Well, you know, originally it sounded a little innocuous, but then I did have the experiences of dealing with some of these guided groups in some other things, like with various park projects and such. And, you know, maybe I should have. And, you know, maybe I was wrong with this. If I had gone in and worked on it on that level, you know, maybe something, I could have done something, and maybe not. You know, I don't know that.
Well, I've been against you on that one.
Yeah, because they are predetermined. What you can do in these meetings is you can cause them to not get to their consensus. You do that by having enough people who just keep asking reasoned questions and never let it proceed to the consensus, because your questions aren't being answered and you just keep asking them, and finally it drives them nuts. They quit, go home, and do something underhanded. That's how these community planning meetings work. I have in front of me the, quote, Growing Smart User Manual.
Oh, dear.
And it's for the Growing Smart Legislative Guidebook, Model Statutes for Planning and the Management of Change. So they're precipitating the change and managing that as they go along in order to guide us right into this globalist new order. Now, this document is produced by the American Planning Association. On the cover, they say, we're making great communities happen. So just rely on your American Planning Association to take control of your life to make your life a great community. But in Chapter 7 of this book, they have a Table 2. It's called Organizing for Neighborhood Planning. The approach, it says, is a neighborhood planning council. And it says, use this when the local government desires a formal, permanent institutional role for neighborhoods that will provide ongoing advice to the legislative body, its agencies, and boards. Now, here in Santa Cruz, they've moved out of little town community planning, and now they're down to neighborhood planning. They've got new legal definitions of what a neighborhood is. The first neighborhood community plan that I know of was approved yesterday down in Pleasure Point, Roy. And what they did there is they took the victory by our hometown citizens in La Selva Beach some years ago. We were the first community plan that was to have a monster house ordinance, prohibitions against monster houses. Well, the people in La Selva Beach stood up and made one of the rare stands against community plan, and we just forced it right out of our community. It hasn't even come back. Everywhere else it keeps coming back. But they got the monster house ordinance, in essence, through the Pleasure Plan, a community plan that was just rammed through the Board of Supervisors yesterday. But all of this stuff ties back to federal funds that come, provided you are living in accordance with the model statutes that come from the American Planning Association in their workbook called Growing Smart User Manual for the Local Planners. So this stuff is highly integrated and organized, and it's blanketed the country, and they all use this same neighborhood community planning model. And it's about as dangerous as can be. Lorraine, we have a caller, Mike from Kentucky. Hello, Mike.
Hey.
What's your question?
Yeah, the attitude seems to be that, you know, owners are not really owners. They're treating you like stakeholders from the get-go. And it's almost as if it's we, the shareholders, electing these administrations. What I seem to have noticed is that land development corporations or whatever go, what is it they call it, dormant? After a politician is no longer in office, where can people go to look at these to see who is on the board of directors? I found one that has everybody listed as president. I always thought there was just one president of a corporation. But you're right. I think this is going on in every county. It's like a corporate veneer over top of our what's supposed to be our real government. Last hour you brought up something about these laws keep getting funded. But I would say, are they really funded because they're not using constitutional money? So, I mean, yeah, well, it goes back to last hour's topic, but the you go to what, the State Department and each state, where do you find who's on these development boards and which one is the, like, umbrella or parent for your county or whatever? Because I think the ones that I've found are actually incorporated, like, county of or state of, you know, in the name, like County of Orange, California Development Corporation, and then there'll be, you know, a list of board of directors and things like that.
Do you have some information for the listener, Lorraine?
I don't really. It's very interesting because there are these little groups that keep popping up all over the place, and we find that, you know, the same developers are turning up all over the country, and they are there when there's an eminent domain project or where there's going to be development in the area. We find that they're very good at contributing to political campaigns. They run out of relatives sometimes when there's, when there's a limit as to how much can be contributed. And, you know, it gets kind of funny if you look at the it's funny, but it's also sad. But when you look at the campaign contributions and you find, like in San Jose, for example, in the last mayoral race, all these homemakers from Shaker Heights, Ohio, contributing to the mayor's campaign. You know, why would anybody in Shaker Heights, especially a homemaker in Shaker Heights, Ohio, be contributing the maximum amount for the mayoral candidate of San Jose?
Or why would there be a corporation in another state named after your town and held by other private individuals?
Have you seen that with your Kentucky town?
Yes, I've seen that. I've seen the city of Moorhead, Kentucky, incorporated in North Carolina with board of directors I don't recognize.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, oh, yeah. I think there's a whole bunch of shell games going on.
Well, there certainly is, and some of them aren't quite as shell as that. But it's the same notion here in Santa Cruz and in San Jose, California. Both of these jurisdictions contract with an international NGO called ICLEI, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. Now, this organization really runs the local politics. They have their social scientists who understand how to maneuver and manipulate local populace.
Well, that's what I was going to get. If they've got a target development that they want to do, I would not be surprised at all that they are spying and profiling and investigating all of the property owners to see who they can soften up and buy out first. And when it gets down to a few holdouts, that's when they do the eminent domain.
Absolutely.
They look for the widows. They look for, they read the death notices. They, there's a lot of things. Yes, it's a very organized system.
And a lot of money.
And certainly in the rural areas in implementing the Wildlands Project.
Well, and I think, too, that these corporations also hold the public land because the federal government never actually comes out and claims that they own it. They manage it.
Pretty good.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Michael, can I be selfish and get in a little bit about eminent domain?
Yes.
We are really very concerned in California that we get an initiative passed which will change the California Constitution and which will prohibit the use of eminent domain for private gain. Our initiative, which you can see on the website, you can download on the website. We have downloadable petitions. We also have a phone number. I will give you both of those. The website is www.limiteminentdomain.org, and the phone number is area code 408-882-5008. Again, we are an all-voluntary grassroots group that is involved in this because we our properties have either been threatened or, in many cases, the properties of people in our group and throughout the state have been taken. We started here in San Jose. We have spread throughout the state. We have very active people from San Diego up to Humboldt County. We're hoping for MODOC way up there, but we haven't heard from anybody up in that part.
We can help you identify someone in MODOC, so we'll talk there.
Great, because actually we've had, since we got title and summary, which was on February 15th, and then thereafter we had to print the petitions and do what had to be done, so it was at least another week. We do have people who have signed from 42 states. But one of the things that...
42 counties, you mean?
Excuse me, 42 counties out of 58 counties. So we're very proud of that, because it is showing again that it is the people's initiative. But one of the things that we're really concerned about is that we have been advised from day one that you cannot get an initiative qualified in California unless you have $2 million in the bank. We don't believe that. That's also because we don't have any delusions of ever getting $2 million. But over and above that, we still believe in a democratic form of government that the people can change the government. In California, we're one of the only states, one of the few states, that has an initiative process. And this was started in 1910. And the reason for the initiative process in California, which you wouldn't know from the last few years of initiatives that we've seen, was that we have a representative form of government in this country. And so we're really not supposed to have to mess around with what happens with government. We're supposed to be able to run our businesses, take care of our homes and our families, and we elect representatives to represent us. Now, in California, in 1910, it was determined that maybe the legislators didn't always do what they were supposed to do. And that's kind of interesting that it's been going on that long. And so, and the initiative process was enacted in law. And what that means, or was supposed to mean, was that when the representatives are not representing the people can determine that the law needs to be changed. And they have to do it by gathering a very large number of signatures. And in our case, we need just probably a breath less than 600,000, which means our goal is 800,000, because sometimes, you know, there people sign and they're not registered voters, or they get on the wrong sheet or something. But that the people should be able to do this. Now, if, in fact, the only way to qualify an initiative is like what we saw in the initiatives last November, where some of the corporate interests who put on initiatives spent $80 million for initiatives, we no longer have a representative government of the people. And we firmly believe that there's only been one other initiative in the state of California that was qualified by volunteer only, and that was Prop 13, the Howard Jarvis initiative. We believe that we can be the next one that qualifies this way. But the only way we can do that is for everyone to get out there and sign the initiative, to get their friends, relatives, and other people they know, so that we can prove that we actually are a democracy of the people and not a paid vote state.
Well, I think I like all of that. I might take a little issue with the democracy part. You know, unfortunately, we're having to exercise democracy in order to salvage the notion of unalienable rights. It is one of the items I like about your initiative, and that is that it goes to a constitutional amendment rather than making this a matter for continuing legislative fodder. You know, the idea of America is that we're not democratic about how somebody uses their property. Your property is your property. I respect your person. I respect your property and your right to mix the two together. And we expect that in return. But our federal Supreme Court has abandoned us in respect to our expectation of this protection by our government of our unalienable rights. And our states, and certainly this state, you know, has long since abandoned its own duty to protect its citizens' natural rights. So this initiative process is one that is designed to instill back into the Constitution in clear and bright language that local governments or state governments cannot go out and take your property and give it to their buddies.
That's right.
Well, tell us again how you get the petition, how you download it from your website.
Our website is www.limiteminentdomain.org. We have downloadable petitions. If you're not comfortable with downloading a petition, go to the phone number, which is area code 408-882-5008, and we can provide hard copies of the petition. They're easy to sign, they're easy to circulate, but you have to follow the rules. Like, you have to have a 1-inch margin at the top of both sides of the paper. It has to be printed on both sides. All of that is included on our website, as well as information as to, you know, who we are and why we're there, and that we are not a special interest group except for one interest, and that is to stop eminent domain abuse in California.
And how are your non-paid signature gatherers doing out there?
Well, they're doing phenomenally. They are so creative. I had this wonderful discussion with a gentleman from Southern California today because he wanted to find out for sure whether he could go to Kinko's and print the petitions because he was going to need a whole lot of them. And he was going to the grocery stores. And he had worked out a system where he designed a table like that goes over the shopping cart. He got permission from the grocery stores to collect there. But he had this so that people would be able to write on a level surface because there were no tables out there. And he had a back thing where he could put up about our initiative and what they were doing. We have people who are who gathered at the peace marches last weekend. We have people at farmers markets. Businesses throughout the state are putting them in their businesses and having their customers, when they come in, sign because they believe that this is such an important issue. So
there are some ideas for the listeners out there. If you're a free enterpriser and you value your free enterprising life, you need to become engaged in this campaign. And you can also contact us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and we'll get some copies of the petition out to you. This is a glorious opportunity, and one that can really begin to bring liberty back here into the state of California. And of course, as California goes, so will go the rest of the country. That's why right now I'm worried about the rest of the country. Well, Lorraine, we've just got a few seconds left here. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And
good job. Thank you.
Any final word for our listeners?
Well, I want to thank you for letting me have this opportunity to talk about this very important issue. And my final word to all of your listeners is, if you don't live in California, if you know anybody who does, tell them about this. Tell them about www.limiteminentdomain.org. We need everybody we can in this army to protect this very, very basic right. And all of your help is necessary, because the only way we can do it
thank
is...
Thank you, Lorraine.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
And check us out, freedom21santacruz.net.